You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, April 30th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, author Andrew Bacevich, on why our military never gets the job done. Meanwhile, John Bolton says North Korea could be the next Libya. South Korean President Moon Jae-in says give Donald Trump the Peace Prize. Meanwhile, at least 29 killed in a Kabul bombing. And outrage at a press dinner as a comedian mentions that Sarah Huckabee Sanders wears makeup. Dems finally less likely to insist on compromise of their elected leaders. Ronny Jackson will no longer be diagnosing presidents. Meanwhile, Trump's golf buddy holds up the biggest health information tech project in history. He's got a great swing. And then there were three, T-Mobile and Sprint, looking to merge. And lastly, Milo Yiannopoulos' conservative welfare ends upon the initiation of a work requirement. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Monday. And of course, over the weekend, there was a horrible outrage. People were incredibly offended by what was said in a more or less public venue. And of course, I'm talking about Donald Trump.
So today, on behalf of the United States, I want to thank every Olympian and Paralympian.
So today, on behalf of the United States, I want to thank every Olympian and Paralympian.
What happened with the Paralympics was so incredible.
That was just incredible.
All right, let's try that one more time.
It's my new Kanye effect.
What, would we play two of them at the same time?
That'll really help our mental health.
So today, on behalf of the United States, I want to thank every Olympian and Paralympian. And that was just incredible. And what happened with the Paralympics was so incredible and so inspiring to me. And I watched, it's a little tough to watch too much, but I watched as much as I could. It was really fantastic, and I want to thank you.
It was a little tough to watch too much.
He does deserve the Peace Prize.
I mean, the idea that that is not what every op-ed and reporter is talking about as being offensive on this Monday is just mind-boggling.
You ever hear of too much of a good thing? It's like the Paralympics. Nothing better
described. Aside from the fact that his like off-the-cuff remarks are just like, it was incredible, and it was really incredible. And then he just immediately goes, but I was disgusted.
I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's really stunning. That's one where you want, like, okay, we've seen the president say it. Let me see the reverse angle on the real human beings who are there, aside from, you know, the only other person you can see react to it is Mike Pence, and he, whatever halcyon he's taking or whatever it is, you know, to keep his himself expressionless except for looking like sad. I mean, really just unbelievable, this guy. And
he's a really bad person.
I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner because it's a slow news day, and we'll talk about it in the fun half, frankly, and just the outrage of these emanating from conservative whiny-ass TD crybabies, frankly, is ridiculous and laughable and worth mocking in and of itself. But the idea that the president is this guy is, I don't know, it's unbelievable. Folks, I don't know if you are a social butterfly like Michael, let's say, who maybe occasionally needs a recovery after a night out. I'm not saying anything, but maybe if you took a couple of those packs over there, you would show up for work a little more often.
Let me
tell
you,
let me
say real quick. So first of all, I mean, obviously, no, I won't be showing up to work more often, but I have taken those on a couple of occasions and they've helped quite a bit.
Okay, so this is what I did when I went to Vegas. I brought a couple of these because I know that I may indulge slightly in drinking too much. But of course, it's also great for traveling. If you want to avoid jet lag or altitude sickness, and if I ever decide to work out, I'm sure that it would be helpful in replenishing and hydrating after that. Liquid IV is a non-GMO electrolyte drink mix. It's vegan, free of gluten, dairy, and soy. It provides the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water, faster and more efficiently than water alone. It's a powder. You pour it into your water. Liquid IV donates one serving to people in need for every order placed. Contains 5 essential vitamins, including more vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. This stuff is great, and I know you're going to love it. If you find yourself in need of a hydration, this is the thing. Right now, my listeners get 20% off of liquidiv.com. It's liquid-iv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off of anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Go to liquid-iv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY to get your savings and start getting better hydration. That's liquid-iv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. And if you are one of those travelers, you love to travel, I hope you figured out by now that the best way to travel is by staying in vacation homes. Blowing off the hotel and stay in a home that gives you the opportunity to cook by for yourself when you want to. They have all sorts of amenities and get a bunch of people to stay together. It's much more fun. Don't visit a ton of sites on tripping.com. One search lets you compare every home from the world's top vacation rental sites in one place. You can find the best deal on your perfect vacation rental. Like I say, you get more privacy. You get more space for everyone under one roof. I mean, if you're going with a bunch of people, why stay in different hotel rooms? You can all get your own private rooms in a house and hang out together. Fully stocked kitchens, sometimes a hot tub, all sorts of amenities. All the comforts of home and then some. Best of all, at tripping.com, you can join millions of travelers who find more savings with rates up to 80% less than traditional hotel rooms. This year, save time and money when you book a vacation home of your dreams with tripping.com/majority. That's tripping, tripping.com/majority. Find your perfect vacation rental, tripping.com/majority. Check it out, folks. I haven't taken a vacation since we started, but this is like I keep going on there and like literally every day, not every day, but I would say every third day, I'm like, well, I should go here.
Yeah, man.
Newly single, go on a big vacation.
Yeah, all of a sudden you'll be the one like, hey, Mike, can you cover for me today, man?
Exactly. Meanwhile, however, still, one thing that's making it possible for me to cook for the kids, blueapron.com. It's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. I literally pitched this yesterday. I was at the Botanical Gardens with Saul and a friend, and she brought her her kid, and I was like, "You should try Blue Apron." I don't know why I mentioned that, but it's true. They deliver fresh, non-GMO, pre-proportioned ingredients, step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based upon what's in season and designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. Customers can pick 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what best fits their schedule. We get 2 a week. And usually we get it now. It's divvied up between Nick gets one, I get one for the kids. Now for 6 weeks, from April 16th through May 21st, Blue Apron is teaming up with Airbnb to bring you the best home cooking from around the world. Each week, their menu will feature a recipe developed in collaboration with an Airbnb experiences. Like a host like Cece, a chef from Shanghai who makes incredible Kung Pao chicken.
That's so cool.
That is cool. I actually am thinking right now, I've mentioned this before, but the one with the big noodles, like round...
Soba noodles?
No. Like some type of pasta. It's like a pasta, but it's a Chinese dish, but like round, like noodle, like shallots almost. I don't know. I'm not saying it right.
Shredded noodles.
But I still, now, like whenever it's so ingrained in my head. Whenever I talk about Blue Apron, I think about that. Check out this week's menu. Get your first 3 menus free at blueapron.com/majority. This is easy. blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Andrew Bacevich. Later in the program, we'll go through this, and we will be introducing another feature based upon, it's really a feature, it's only going to last till Wednesday, but there's a lot of talk of what might come out of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I'm not gonna tip anything. I don't want to do any spoiler alerts, but we will have a new feature based upon our anticipating a response to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I gotta say, I mean, I think that whole thing is a joke. I think it should have been canceled years ago. Or you know what? Well, we'll get to it. I don't want to get into it right now. But we're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Andrew Bacevich. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Andrew Bacevich, a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His most recent book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, a military history, has been out since almost 2 years to the day, I guess. Well, I guess it was July that we had you on the program. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on.
Glad to be with you.
I wanted to talk about your piece, specifically about the piece that you wrote for Tom Dispatch, and was reprinted in The Nation magazine. The United States has a superb military that never gets the job done. And then, more broadly, to talk about where we are in terms of foreign policy, at least in I think you would argue that it's far too reliant on our military. But before we get there, what do you mean by a superb military that never gets the job done?
Well, I mean, the purpose of going to a war, to any war, is to accomplish vital political objectives that can't be accomplished in any other way. That is to say that the resort to force ought to be the last choice available. So we made a choice. We made a choice after the end of the Cold War to place greater reliance on military power as something to be put to use, not simply to be held in reserve for purposes of defense or deterrence. And I think that the impact of 9/11 affirmed that inclination. And so the George W. Bush administration declaring a global war on terrorism, that was their phrase, set out to transform large parts of the Islamic world so that those parts, places like Afghanistan, would never again be the source of terrorist attacks directed against us. And we've been pursuing this purpose, not only in Afghanistan, but also in Iraq, in Somalia, in Libya, and elsewhere ever since, with no evidence of achieving our basic declared objectives. And seems to me that that means we don't win. We may have a great military, but it doesn't win. And therefore, there's something fundamentally wrong that ought to be a concern to citizens.
I want to get into the seven principles that you argue define the what you say the prevailing military system of the United States, and but where is the delineation? Because as you, you use the term military system, and I think maybe that's the key of this. But where is the delineation between the military as simply a tool, and then the civilian leadership making a conscious decision to use it in a different way? And then even as you talk about Bush and the global war on terror, to my mind, all I can think is that there is another unstated agenda, which, going back a little further, a lot of the people who populated the Bush administration in the Project for New American Century, they envisioned the United States as a hyperpower, one which just basically put the lid on a lot of low-level regional conflicts. I mean, and in some ways, that is what it seems to me is the global war on terror. That's not really that the global war on terror is just a pretense to sort of try and just keep these small conflicts, going but not exploding around the world. What's your take on that?
I'm not sure I fully agree with the second point, but let's go back to the first point you were making about the distinction between the military and civilians. I think it really was the key point. And I think with regard to our elites, there is no distinction. That is to say that the group of people, some of them in power, others basically either commenting on power or hoping to become part of the power structure, has become thoroughly militarized. Now, the process of imbuing the establishment with a military mind view certainly began during the Cold War, took root during the Cold War. But remember that the overarching purpose of the American military during the Cold War was to avert war. It was to make sure World War III didn't happen. Now, lesser wars did happen, Korea, Vietnam being the two largest examples, Vietnam being the most instructive example of what can happen when you put the military instrument to work where it's inappropriate. But nonetheless, as long as the Cold War continued, the idea was, we're doing what we're doing. We're shoveling all this money to the Pentagon because we believe that doing so will prevent World War III from happening. Cold War ends, prospect of World War III now rapidly diminished, and that's where I think that civilian elites at this point, already militarized, began to revise their thinking about the purposes of military power. And I think Bill Clinton actually is an excellent example of that. You know, here we have a guy whose track record as a young person was decidedly anti-military, went out of his way to avoid service in Vietnam. And yet when he becomes president, we see this extraordinary pattern of military interventionism, whether we're talking his escalation in Somalia back in 1993, incursion into Haiti, the Bosnia-Kosovo conflicts, his willingness to launch airstrikes, whether against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or against Saddam Hussein as part of the effort to keep Saddam Hussein, quote-unquote, in his box. And I think that the Clinton period illustrates this basic change in thinking about what military power exists for. And what it exists for now is it becomes an instrument, we think, Clinton thinks, others think, it's an instrument to solve problems. So I think that's a key point. The civilian establishment itself has embraced a thoroughly militarized mindset. Now, I've already forgotten the second question.
Well, the second part is how, when we get to the Bush administration,
Oh, I'm sorry. I got it now. Yeah.
But let me just restate, though.
I remember now. So, okay. But here's what I would say. I think it's very important not to overstate the influence of the neoconservatives on Bush foreign policy. It was substantial. I myself simply don't buy the notion that somehow the neocons were driving the train. Among other things, Bush himself was not a neoconservative. I don't know that President Bush had any well-developed thoughts about foreign policy when he became president. But more importantly, the most important figures in his administration with regard to foreign policy, namely Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, they were not neoconservatives. They didn't believe in spreading democracy like Wolfowitz certainly did. What Cheney and Rumsfeld believed in was dominance, power. They weren't particularly interested in democratizing the Islamic world. They wanted to force the Islamic world into submission so that there would be no further attacks. Now, what the neoconservatives and the imperialists, if I could call them that, like Cheney and Bush shared, what they shared in common was an overstated sense of what military power can do. They both thought that military power was the key to achieving primary U.S. objectives. That was a fundamental error on their part, and we saw that fundamental error manifest itself, of course, after the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that Cheney was that he wasn't necessarily a neocon, but signed on to that some of those PNAC documents that basically promoted. And I think as Wolfowitz said it, they came to agreement on, you know, in that case of weapons mass destruction, but they all had their agendas. But like you say, there's an overlap between these sort of neo-imperialists and these neoconservatives in the sense that, maybe one tells themselves another story about why they want to be imperialist, you know, because they're doing good or spreading democracy. And the other one is just I want access to what's there. I want to prevent other people from having access to what's there. But that the idea was that that their agenda was such that there has been this shift in the way that these people. But I guess. And I guess to a certain extent, you've answered that in that they perceive themselves as part of the military anyways, that the distinction of the military being becoming just another tool in the toolbox as opposed to.
But the preferred tool.
Right.
The best tool in their view, the tool that if employed would necessarily achieve the purposes that they wanted to achieve. That's what that mindset, which again I think emerges from the aftermath of the Cold War, was very prevalent in the upper reaches of the George W. Bush administration, regardless of whether we're calling these people neoconservatives
right,
or not.
Right. I mean, I only brought up PNAC because that's where this vision of the hyperpower and these low-level conflicts around the world was expressed, maybe in other places, but that's the one where I was aware of it. But that's also what Donald Rumsfeld came in on day one and was like, we're going to refashion the military to make it basically like a little bit easier to use in some way, to make it a little more flexible.
Absolutely. On that point, Rumsfeld viewed the military itself as the problem, that these stodgy old generals and admirals who still believed in big armored divisions and huge aircraft carriers, from Rumsfeld's point of view, those guys simply didn't get it. They didn't get that the nature of war was changing rapidly, and that therefore, for the United States to exploit its military advantages that it had inherited as a result at the end of the Cold War, there needed to be a radical redesign of the American military. And on that point, in some respects, part of Rumsfeld's agenda was to see the Iraq War as the instrument that would promote that internal transformation. That by achieving victory in Iraq, that would help break through the resistance of the admirals and the generals to his reform agenda. But of course, when the war didn't turn out the way he thought it was going to be, then his reform agenda went down the toilet.
But did it? I mean, it seems to me that the reliance on drones, that the elevation of of JSOC and special operations was at least in part of his vision.
I think that's fair enough. In part, that is true. But it was not part of his vision for the United States to be engaged in wars in unimportant places for year after year after year right. after year, and that's what we've got.
And before we go into those seven principles, because really important to understanding your argument here. But I should also ask too, was that Rumsfeld? And maybe I'm just restating it, but it was not just that his perception of the nature of war was going to change, but the value of war was going to change. The value to the United States was going to change.
Right. Yes, right. It would now become something that we could use, and we could use frequently, and we could use it with minimal risk. That a reformed American military would be able to achieve results quickly, efficiently, and economically. And let's recall that as the Operation Iraqi Freedom unfolded in its initial weeks, that seemed to validate Rumsfeld's expectations. You know, the U.S. forces got to Baghdad in no time whatsoever, overthrew the Saddam Hussein regime. U.S. casualties were low. At that point, non-combatant casualties were low, and it looked like a great victory. Indeed, it looked like a victory with transformative implications. Unfortunately for Rumsfeld, the war didn't end when Bush declared mission accomplished. Indeed, the war was only beginning, and the war that then ensued through 2004, 2005, 2006, and so on, was a war that basically undermined the reform project that he represented.
All right, let's take your seven principles, and if we could, I'd like to go with the seventh first and work our way down to the ones that you think is the heart of the matter. And just starting with principle seven, the seventh being that our military system invests great confidence in something that you call the military profession. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think first I should explain what I mean by that phrase, military system, because I don't think I don't think that phrase is commonly used, at least in the way I intended it. And my basic argument is that there are a set of habits or practices that are rarely examined, but that together explain why our military is constituted the way it is and why it's employed the way we employ it. These are things that predate 9/11. This is not something that just happened. And one of those aspects is the notion of a military profession. That is to say that there is a separate class of people who have acquired great expertise in understanding and conducting war, and that the rest of us who are not military professionals ought to defer to members of the military profession when it comes to matters related to war, that they know things we don't know, and therefore they should be allowed to exercise a great authority, either in designing forces or in employing them in wartime. I mean, basically what we're talking about is the admirals and the generals that are at the top of the heap, the three stars and the four stars.
And so what is dangerous about that? I mean, is it a function of it creates incentives that may be misaligned with how we want to willing we are to use the military? Is it that?
I think the danger is. There is a danger if the belief in military professionalism results in too little oversight over the military. In other words, surgeons undergo extraordinary training in order to be able to do what they do in operating rooms. And we have some amount of confidence when we choose to submit to surgery that the person who is going to cut us open, that he or she knows what they're doing. We probably consult. We probably get second opinions. And when that surgery is done, if it doesn't come out the way it's supposed to, we sort of get angry and say, what the hell's going on here? We demand accountability. And I think the same thing ought to apply to members of the military profession. Again, here we are in 2018, and the United States military, in my estimation, since 9/11, hadn't got it done. Therefore, the people in charge of our wars, the admirals and the generals, there ought to be some effort to insist upon accountability. And I'm simply suggesting that it's time for us to ask, are we choosing the right people to run our wars? Are we developing them? You know, by the time you get to be a four-star general, you've probably been in the military for 26, 28, 30 years. Is that experience properly preparing these people for the responsibilities that they're going to exercise? I think that it's past time for us to scrutinize the performance of our senior military officers, and therefore to come to some determination that maybe it's time to have reforms so that they perform better than they have been over the past 18 years or so.
I mean, I guess this is, part of the dilemma of the professionalization is like, how would we go about doing that? I mean, because it seems to me this is the dilemma, right?
Well, imagine if we have evidence of a high rate of failure in heart surgery across the board. What would one do? I mean, what would our society do? I imagine that there would be established some kind of a commission to study in depth why things have gone wrong and to propose ways to improve the performance of surgeons.
We can't even do that for the banks. I mean, honestly, we haven't had the ability to do that with our financial system.
Well, that could be, but the answer to the question, it seems to me, is to undertake a serious, even-handed study of the problem in order to try to discern what solutions can be. You may be right that the way our society is organized or the way it operates these days, the people in positions of power are never held to account. I mean, you can make an argument that says that. But my answer to your question is they ought to be held to account, and right. I think that there are pretty obvious ways to do that.
Okay, and let's go to six. The based on the terms of our military system, the armed services have been designed not to defend the country, but to project military power on a global basis. And this is, you're talking about the way the Pentagon divvies up the world into swaths of territory, and you made the analog just for people to just imagine if President Xi Jinping had decided to create the PRC Latin American Command, headed by a four-star Chinese general charged with maintaining order and stability from Mexico to Argentina, we would freak out.
We would. So, again, I mean, in a sense, the purpose of the article is to invite readers to step back and think critically about things that we all have come to take for granted. And the fact that the Pentagon divides up the world the way it does, with European Command and Africa Command and Central Command and Southern Command and Pacific Command, the fact that we put a four-star admiral or general in charge of each of those commands, the fact that that this officer is somehow or other expected to maintain stability, advance our interests in that region, the fact that we've got U.S. forces today located in probably somewhere around 150 countries around the world, that we've got, plus or minus 800 bases, all this is taken for granted. And it seems to me that it's time for us to ask seriously, does this work? Is this advancing our interests? Is it making us more secure? And if not, are there alternatives? It's a deep-seated habit that we're supposed to have U.S. forces scattered everywhere. It's a deep-seated habit that the purpose of the United States Army is not to defend the United States, but it is to go fight in faraway places. I think it's time. That is part of our military system. I think it's a part of our military system that's overdue for reexamination.
I know that during, maybe it was in the mid-aughts, I would imagine the number's probably higher now because I don't think that we've closed any, but we had something like 750, some odd, maybe 780 bases around the world.
That's right, and nobody else does that. And it's fair to say, I'm not in favor of the People's Republic of China creating a Latin America command, but it's fair to ask the question of whether or not that habit that we have indulged for the last several decades is still pertinent or might be counterproductive. And by no means am I the first person to suggest this, but I think it's part of that system that I tried to lay out that demands scrutiny.
Your fifth principle is centers around the concept that when we declare war, there doesn't seem to be the implications of the cost associated with that war does not seem to be an issue whatsoever. And this is really about sort of, and I think as we go down in these principles, as we go count them down, the idea here is to increase the awareness of the American public as to what we're doing as far as our military system.
Right. So very few of us serve or have members of our family who serve. And that alone, of course, is one factor that leads us to tune out wars. But a second contributing factor is that we're not paying for the wars that are waged in our name. You know, when there was a time, World War II would be an example, when the nation went to war, it went to war in two ways. Number one, the manpower, and it was mostly men, the manpower of the nation was mobilized to fight, but also taxes went up. I mean, in World War II, they didn't go up to cover the entire cost of the war, but they went up substantially, so that every American household, therefore, was contributing to the war effort, and also had an appreciation for the fact that there was a war on. In recent years, we go to war and we cut taxes. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. The Republican Party, which purports to care about fiscal responsibility, in fact, doesn't, and in particular doesn't with regard to paying for war costs. So we've spent, since 9/11, not that anybody actually is able to put a number on it or wants to put a number on it, but we've certainly expended trillions of dollars. And given downstream costs, for example, veterans care, the fiscal implications of the wars going on now will continue to be felt for many decades. And quite frankly, from a political perspective, who cares? Politicians don't care. People don't care. But that has become part of our military system, that we go to war and we ignore the fact that these wars are costing a lot of money and that somebody someday downstream is going to have to pay the bill.
I'm required to just put an asterisk here and say that I have a slightly different perspective on our ability to absorb costs. But I agree with you totally that the absence that the there's a very good use of taxation is to make people conscious of priorities. And of what we're or just being conscious of what's going on, and this we get down to principles one and two, which is I think the key. But before we get there, in principles four and three, you discuss the role of Congress and its, I guess, abdication of that role when it comes to war.
Well, I mean, it relates to the commander in chief. So I actually don't, when I was a kid, I do not remember all that frequently the sitting president being referred to as commander-in-chief.
Yes.
Commander-in-chief Truman or commander-in-chief Eisenhower. But somehow, especially in recent decades, the notion that the president is commander-in-chief has come to be very much central to his function and identity. And the Congress, I think, has fed that inclination and has found it convenient to defer to the commander-in-chief, lest the Congress itself, of course, be actually found responsible for anything that's going on in the conduct of our wars. So it would be good to have serious, responsible legislative oversight in military affairs, and there is some oversight, but I tend to think it's pretty perfunctory, that, you know, there's hearings and they ask questions and they get testimony. And once in a while, some poor general or assistant secretary is going to get poked in the ribs because there's a cost overrun on a weapon system. But the truth is there's no serious accountability. So I see that as really an abject failure on the part of the Congress. And I think that deferring to the so-called commander-in-chief to do whatever the hell he wants to do, Trump's most recent strike against Syria would be one example of that. I think that has not contributed to prudent, well thought out military policies. I think that it actually has underwritten the kind of recklessness that is particularly in evidence with Donald Trump.
What do you think accounts for? And maybe it's post 9/11 where the phrase commander in chief is used, because I don't remember people referring to Clinton that way as much. But what do you think accounts for? Like I say, maybe it's 9/11, but it seems to me it's incredibly dangerous to start to refer to the president as commander in chief, particularly they do this outside of the context of the military, his role or her role in regards to the military. And then, you know, we're seeing under Trump, as you say, even more militarization. You know, John Kelly should be referred to as the chief of staff. He should not be referred to as General John Kelly. I understand that that may be, you know, somewhat traditional in the context of someone who's retired, but he should be referred to as the chief of staff, but yet he's the general. And it seems to me to be very problematic, you know, beyond even how problematic it is in terms of the accountability for the military.
You know, it's interesting on that point. When Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952, he adamantly insisted that in office, he would not be referred to as General Eisenhower, that he would be referred to as Mr. President, because Eisenhower came from a tradition in which emphasizing the fact that the president was a civilian who presided over the military. To Eisenhower, that was Eisenhower, the career military officer. To Eisenhower, that was very important. And that's just another one of those things that's kind of gone by the board since.
So let's talk about the first and second of your principles, which you say are the heart of the matter. That being that we have non-serving citizens are encouraged to support the troops. There's really no clear way. I guess, you know, at one point we were putting yellow ribbons on our magnets on our cars in the aughts. And the other element being that military service is now an entirely voluntary endeavor. I mean, talk about the implications of these two elements of our military system.
Well, I'm certainly not the only one making this point, and that is that that aspect of our military system, the reliance on a so-called all-volunteer force, which in fact is a professional military, that has contributed to a gap between the military and American society. Now, these sort of bits of performance art, you know, like cheering for the troops at halftime in a football game, conceal that gap. But the gap is a very real one, and it manifests itself in sort of a public obliviousness to what our soldiers are off there doing, at what cost, for what purpose, when's it going to end. There's remarkably little public attention to that, and of course, because there's a little public attention, therefore our political establishment doesn't have any incentive to pay attention. So I have come to believe that the existence of the all-volunteer military is really the original sin, and it is the principal obstacle the principal obstacle to reorienting our policies in a way that are more prudent, more realistic, and perhaps would get us out of this circumstance of endless war that we're trapped in.
I couldn't agree more. It seems to me to be the sine qua non of accountability. I mean, if you have if you don't have a broad based participation in the sacrifices that are involved in this, there's no one to push back upon the reliance on the military as, you know, a first measure policy instrument. And I think it also, we see it ripple through society, because I think the problems that we have now with the media in the way that they cover war and the way that they talk about war and the way that they talk about how beautiful the missiles can be, and that, you know, they refer to the generals as much as Donald Trump does, is a function of that. They are, when you have such a narrow subset of our citizenry who is actually like having to deal with the realities of these things, it becomes super easy and almost contingent upon others to glorify this stuff.
I agree with you 100%, and you said it better than I did.
Let me ask you this in closing, because, you know, I'm talking to a writer who wrote about sort of the a left foreign policy in this country. Is there, from your perspective, is there a vacuum that is created because there has been no, and maybe, I don't know, and let me ask your opinion on this, as to ideological differences in foreign policy. We have never, it seems to me, had a robust, broad-based debate of foreign policy on any type of ideological grounds. And I wonder if that creates a vacuum that allows this type of drift.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, so the Republicans, broadly speaking, and Democrats, broadly speaking, don't agree on every issue of foreign policy, but both parties actually agree to this military system that we've just been discussing. And in that sense, both parties are themselves militarized. What we need is one party that believes adamantly in military power, thinks we should be the strongest military power in the world now and forever, believes in using war to achieve our political purposes, and we should have another party that believes just the opposite, that it may not be called an anti-war party, but it needs to be a party that is highly skeptical of what military power can do. And if we had two parties like that, then we could have a really interesting debate, a much-needed debate. But as long as we have two parties that are, in different ways, but nonetheless, are both militarized, then that needed debate just doesn't happen.
Andrew Bacevich, the piece is "The United States Has a Superb Military That Never Gets the Job Done." We will link to it at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break here and then head into our fun half. Actually, maybe we should make this announcement in the free show, because this is, we don't do projects like this. And let me just get a little bit serious at this moment, because as you know, this weekend, there was the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And this was a woman, Michelle Wolf, who comes from a Netflix show.
Writer on The Daily Show.
She was a writer on The Daily Show?
She is, yeah.
Oh, she's a writer on the current Daily Show.
Yeah, and now she's got a deal with a new Netflix show.
And she's got to deal with a new Netflix show. Thank you. I was not familiar with her work, as I am not familiar with anyone's work if they don't work in this office. But she delivered the White House Correspondents' Dinner speech and, of course, and we will play clips of this in the fun half, but apparently she mocked some people in the audience and members of the Trump administration. And this raised the ire of one of the country's great defenders of the comfortable, one of the country's great defenders of the right, the conservative movement, the war in Iraq. He defended us against the inhumanity practiced by the French back in the aughts, arguing that they couldn't, the idea of them finding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was ridiculous. They should go out and find truffles. Of course, I'm talking about Dennis Miller, or Dennis DMZ from Twitter. And
bop, bop, bop.
On Sunday, yesterday, April 29th, at 3:16 a.m. in the morning, East Coast time. This, of course, was 12:16 a.m. Pacific time, where he's located, I hope. He tweeted, "What a horrid human being Michelle Wolf is. I'm going to read up on her over the next couple of days. And I will have a few brutally mean jokes about her by Wednesday."
Oh my God. This is like when the North Koreans announced something.
We have taken this tweet down to our newsroom analysts, and we have determined that Wednesday means this Wednesday, May 2nd. And as such, we are introducing our countdown clock. We are one day, 23 hours, 3 minutes, and 44, 43, 42, 41, 40, so on, seconds. From Dennis Miller's few brutally mean jokes about Michelle Wolf.
Bop, bop, bop. Now, I've heard that these jokes may include a reference to the 1980s version of The Equalizer. There's a possibility of a Karen and Goodfellas reference. as well as some overlap with the Nancy Pelosi material?
I mean, that is going to be one of the big questions, and we'll leave the clock sound up under our analysis of what we can expect in an hour, a day, 23 hours, 3 minutes, and now 2 seconds. So we're right on the verge of almost being, we are now officially 1 day, 23 hours, and 2 minutes away, plus seconds, from the release. Now, I want to be clear here on one thing about the clock. I just get a little meta, if we could, before we get back into the analysis of what we anticipate for the brutally mean jokes. We have determined, and let's just turn the seconds down just a little bit. We did not know if Dennis Miller was referring to Wednesday at that being 12 a.m. in the first hour of Wednesday. So what we have done is we have split the difference. We have assumed that it will be noon Eastern time that we are designating Wednesday. We don't know, and we, of course, have a team of reporters on it right now.
It's part of dealing with Miller. I mean, the explosiveness, the unexpectedness, you don't know whether there's going to be a sort of, you know, teacher having sex with students from the 1990s reference. We don't know, again, is it going to be Scorsese-based? Is it going to involve a Roman reference that's inappropriate, in fact, to the context of the joke he's attempting? These are the types of things that you can't game out with a guy like this.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. So we've split the difference. We have a team of reporters who are trying to find out if we have a more specific time, but we're going to go with this as the countdown clock. And, you know, the question is what is it? And I want to, can we bring his tweet back up for a moment? And I just want to... we bring the tweet back up on the big board. Okay, so I want to try and underline, and if you could, Matt, if you could just highlight for me with your, I want you to highlight over the, read up on her over the next couple of days. I don't know if you can do that. We got to get our tech people back up on the big board. So read up on her over the next couple of days. So Miller's not going to be shooting from the hip
here. No, this is a pro.
This is a guy who's going to dig deep. He's going to get some real stuff, and he's going to deliver it. This isn't going to be we're not going to hear stuff about her like it's going to be – unless he's going to read up like about like – her hair.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, you might think, hey, she's a stupid, frizzy haired comedian with a voice I find annoying. Might be, by the way, her own material. So that would be an easy lane for Miller to go. But I think we're going to get deep. We're going to get she's annoying, has frizzy hair, was mean to Sarah Huckabee, and has a Netflix special. I think this is the type. I mean, and it's interesting that he's actually kind of releasing trade secrets on this, which I think should add. You know, if I'm Michelle Wolf right now, I'm going to be really wary.
All right. I'm going to pull something up here. And if we could, I'm going to try and bring this up. All right. Here it is. Okay. Because this is what I think this is going to be pretty key. Let me see if I can't send this to Matt right now. Because there's a couple of things I want you to think about. He may be doing some writing. See, Matt, let's see if you can pull this up on the big board here for me. This is an image. And contemplate this for a moment. He's going to be doing some reading, so I know we're going to get some very deep stuff. But here is Michelle Pfeiffer, not Michelle Wolf, but Michelle Pfeiffer from the movie Married to the Mob. Now, this is a movie that came out in 1988. So this is ripe.
This is right in
this
his time
ripe.
Zone.
This is
this
right
is exactly
in Dennis Miller's
in his cultural reference.
Reference
time zone. That's
this
right.
is in his reference wheelhouse. Now it may be a little bit too leaning forward in terms of its ripeness, but it's more or less ripe. But I want you to compare her hair with that of Michelle Wolf's. Do we have a picture of Michelle Wolf's? Can we bring up a picture of Michelle Wolf? Because I think what you're going to find is that it is similar enough that he could be saying something, and I don't want to, you know, get out ahead because the last, I mean, look at that, right? Right?
I think the joke pretty much writes itself, and if you can put in a reference to Cicero here, you're really on the money.
I sense if he could, if the question is when he builds his columns, right? His AB column. Michelle Pfeiffer, Married to the Mob in
That's
one,
right.
Michelle Wolf in the other, ba-ba-ba, she's got the hair, wanted to see what was going to happen, and then maybe, I think it was one of the Baldwin brothers in the thing, and then work in Star Trek.
Well, Star Trek will need to be there, I think there's no doubt about that. But and then
she's got that Michelle, she's got that Michelle Pfeiffer tribble hair from Married to the Mob, except for she's married to the...
The liberal establishment. Except she's married to the liberal establishment. She's married to the swamp. There you go.
The swamp.
Although the swamp, again, might still be a little too
current.
Doesn't
rhyme to mob.
Miller standards. But I think I think, though, that you could also see an inversion where if he goes with a Baldwin brother comparison, he could go with a, like, I like that Baldwin brother more than Alec Baldwin, just like I like Pfeiffer in the mob movie more than I like Michelle Wolf. Right. The classic Miller bop, bop, bop inversion.
Right. Oh, that's good. Well, I guess, look, we have a day, 22 hours and 57 minutes now and 46, 45, 44 seconds to think about this more and to prepare ourselves.
And if
for
I'm
the,
Michelle
for the
Wolf right now, you know, I'm on Wikipedia looking up, you know, who is Dennis Miller? Maybe I'm looking at some clips that perhaps we have done where Bill O'Reilly stares blankly, depressed and bloated into space. Well, Dennis Miller makes those very
we've got
Star
to check
Trek
on
references.
her tweets.
We're going to need to see what, you know, because I'm going to imagine she feels a lot of pressure about this.
But we've got people, folks in our newsroom downstairs are looking at what possibly could be the reading into Michelle Wolf that he is doing. And so we will try and bring this up and present this tomorrow to get a sense of where we think some of these jokes are coming from. All right. In the meantime, we have got to take a break and head into the fun half. We will update you. We will have this countdown clock on perhaps throughout the rest of the show, through tomorrow's show. Of course, I'm going to be walking around with it in my pocket. I've got an app now.
I bought a Google Watch just so I can have it.
That's right. So that we are awaiting with bated breath the jokes.
Oh yeah, a few. I mean, these could be plural. I mean, this is
well.
This
he said few,
real.
And
yeah,
so
a few. Yeah.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the fun half. Just a reminder: this program exists because of our members. Our members support this program day in, day out, and for just really pennies a day, pennies, a lot of pennies. I mean, more like dimes a day, several dimes a day, including the weekends. Dimes a day. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you the fun half. You can join at jointhemajorityreport.com. And if you do not have the finances to enjoy the fun half, but you would like to, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Wait a few days, like until the next coming Wednesday, if you will. And you'll hear from us eventually, and we will hook you up. We don't turn anybody away. Also, today is the day, the last day. If you wanted to get Just Coffee with 30% discount, you got to do it now. You literally got to do it now. When you hear this, do it. JustCoffee.coop, 30% off, free shipping. Go and check it out. Also, go back, check out our sponsors today. We had some good ones, Blue Apron, Tripping, Liquid IV, all products that... I haven't used Tripping yet, but I plan to. I just need to take a vacation. Don't forget, tomorrow night is Tuesday, which means that tomorrow night will be TMBS. The best way to prepare for tomorrow night's The Michael Brooks Show is to go back and listen to last week's by subscribing at iTunes or checking it out on our YouTube page. But either way you do it, best to subscribe to iTunes, and then you have the opportunity of listening to it and then going and viewing it. All right, 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a moment. Oh, also, don't forget to check out Jamie's Patreon page, patreon.com/antifada. Check it out. All right, here we go.